Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Ravenpuffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join our Facebook group, the Ravenpuff Common Room, and on Instagram at the Rambling Ravenpuffs.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/therambling ravenpuffs, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in. Grab your butterbeer and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Ravenpuffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today, we do not have any new chapters. This is our special wrap-up episode for Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, the second installment in the series. So, Jess, you had a week to, like, process everything, mull it over. Overall, your comments on Chamber of Secrets.
Well, first of all, I just want to say you'll be very proud of me because I've started working Harry Potter references into my daily life. Like, I compared somebody to Lockhart. I compared somebody had like Hagrid's house as their Zoom background. I don't know. So I think I've called myself Hagrid. Out of the two books that we've read so far, I enjoyed this. I thought that it was scary and suspenseful and fun and, you know, just kind of could stand by itself enough away from Philosopher's Stone, but also I enjoyed it. I feel like I say that all the time and I'm kind of like a Pollyanna about everything, but I think the thing I'm most curious about now is why people don't like this book. But how was your reread of this book?
Well, I think my reread was about really the comparisons between Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, and by extension, again, I think I was being maybe a little harsh that it's not so much people like hate this book or even dislike it by any means. It's just a testament to how, you know, amazing the rest of the books are.
Cool.
And for me personally, I don't think there's any substantial in terms of wow, gee whiz, or like plot or whatever. I don't think there's anything substantially better or worse in the first two books. It's just more of the nostalgia of the first book being the introduction into this world.
That makes sense.
And I was comparing a lot about between Chamber of Secrets and Philosopher's Stone and the idea of, you know, the MacGuffin. You know what the MacGuffin term means?
You may have mentioned it and I may have been like, I probably should know what this means and not say and just not say anything. So explain. Yeah, I was like, yeah, that sounds good. I'm learning a lot from my coworkers.
The MacGuffin is just a literary term for when there's an object that is like the plot device that everyone is hunting after it.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Like R2-D2 is the MacGuffin in, you know, Star Wars.
Okay. That's so that probably originated from something that I don't.
I don't know the exact origins of what that was. But basically, when it's an object that everyone is like trying to get, or like Shadow of the Wind, the book that Daniel has, or David. Okay. I can't even remember the guy's name.
We've read so many books. Okay, I get it. I'm hung up on this, on like when somebody says something jumps the shark, that's like specifically a Happy Days reference, which I think is pretty interesting, but I'll have to see what the MacGuffin is. But I'm glad to have some context around it.
So for Philosopher's Stone, we have a very stark, obvious MacGuffin, the Philosopher's Stone, in the titular object of the story.
Right.
And so it follows that one, which I am beginning to see, like a lot of people complain that the MacGuffin is a very simple and cheap plot device to get the story going. But I find myself lately in the fantasy that I'm reading, like I will read it and I'm like, oh, I really missed the MacGuffin, like chasing after the shiny magical object. Like I just recently read A Court of Silver Flames.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah.
Which in that story, there are a few MacGuffins that have to be, you know, chased after across the fairy realms. And I'm just like, yeah, I'm all for this again.
I kind of like it. I mean, it's an intriguing way to move a story along. And yeah, I get it. Yeah. I get it. I'm so thinking I'm reading a domestic thriller right now.
What else do you read?
Yeah, I know. I kind of in my little sweet spot there, but I'm not very far into it yet.
Yeah. So, you know, Philosopher's Stone is all about the MacGuffin and the Philosopher's Stone. And in many ways, it's a super like well-hidden MacGuffin in a way that Harry could have gone through Philosopher's Stone, like his school year, and not have known any of this or done anything about it.
Right.
And this just would have been stolen in secrets. There would have been, of course, later implications, obviously, if Voldemort had gotten a hold of the stone. But right. He could have gone through his, you know, academic year not thinking about this, and nothing would have happened immediately. Whereas in Chamber of Secrets, like, there is no MacGuffin per se, and the big bad that's happening, like, it's much more offensive, like, children are being attacked, and so it's much more direct that we've got to do something about this.
Yeah, I was going to say, could there be an argument made that the MacGuffin in this is Tom Riddle's diary?
That it, in a way, it is in part because, yeah, it's a coveted item that gets stolen away from Harry. So clearly okay. It has something of value. And then Harry's like, where is Riddle's diary and stuff like that? So yeah, definitely to a lesser degree, Tom Riddle's diary could be a MacGuffin, but it's not the ultimate, you know, thing going on. It's that there's a big giant snake attacking everyone.
Yeah, that's kind of the main thing. So cool.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of any other, where are my notes? I wrote a few notes in this cute little notebook that my sister got me for my birthday, which has kitties on it that says every day is Catterday.
That ain't that the truth. That's the world I want to live in, for sure.
And then, of course, the obvious one is Philosopher's Stone is all about the intro, the MacGuffin, again, the bells and whistles of all this magical stuff going around. And so in Philosopher's Stone, we're just getting, you know, the foundations of, like, the very superficial level of this wizarding society. Yes. And so now, and then in Chamber of Secrets, we get the darker underbelly of the society of institutionalized racism.
Yes. Yeah. We learned, at least I learned a bunch of new terms for different people in different kind of situations. Just a squib and a mudblood. Those are the two main things that stood out as far as prejudices. And personally, I think being a squib would be the worst, in my opinion, because you're basically born to magical parents, but you yourself are not magical. I feel like that would just be a drag.
Yeah, it probably would be a drag. And so, and then notions of slavery. Slavery exists in this society. We learn that in this book.
Yes, with especially kind of demonstrated with Dobby and all the abuse that Dobby receives. And, you know, at the end, we learn who Dobby belongs to. But and I feel like that was kind of obvious, I guess. Maybe I knew that before reading it. Maybe I didn't, but it felt a little obvious. But yes, that is definitely something that they talk about in, or that is demonstrated in here. And I have I feel like this is a good question. I can't claim it as my own. I did a little research. Maybe I should just claim it. But I think that, so this is something I stole from a website, and it says, it's related, so bear with me. Author Phil Pullman, in his 1996 Carnegie Medal acceptance speech, said, "There are some themes, some subjects, too large for adult fiction. They can only be dealt with adequately in a children's book." Do you think that statement is applicable in the elf slavery situation?
I think it is, and just the wider concept of, that quote makes me think of one of the many, you know, documentaries about Harry Potter that I've watched, and one editor, literary critic, was saying, you know, some people at a superficial level dismiss children's books, but in reality, they deal with all of these big questions of whether slavery or, like, love and death and all of these things, rather than the domestic thriller that starts out, oh, my husband cheated on me. What am I going to do?
Yeah, I've always kind of found YA especially is a little more impactful with some of those types of things. I'm thinking particularly of a I hate the title. Sorry if you like it, anybody, but the Song of Songbirds and Snakes or something like that, the latest Hunger Games book.
Oh, the prequel one, yeah. Haven't read any of them, but yeah, I know it has been only mildly received.
Yeah, well, I enjoyed it, and I thought it dealt with some really interesting, very adult themes, like, you know, I don't think, maybe a little bit of capitalism, just kind of undermining people in society and playing the game and stuff like that, which I thought it was handled really well. And that was a YA book compared to some other books that I've read that, and maybe it's just me, but sometimes it goes over my head or sometimes it gets kind of in, there's a phrase I want to use. I'm not going to say it, but it gets too into itself that the message is lost. So,
yeah. And I think maybe in adult books more, the author has a specific stance on one of these wide ranging issues and is trying to make a point to choose one side over the other in a way.
Right.
Whereas children's books, maybe it's more because the nature of them being children's books, it's more just placing the idea out there for children to think about these things, and then as they grow up, they'll make their own judgments on these wider concepts.
I like that. I almost like that better. I mean, yeah, you're exactly right. Sometimes people are presenting information, then they're arguing a very specific side rather than leaving it a little more open-ended for the reader to figure out how they feel about it. I don't know, but if anybody thinks like kicking Dobby's ass constantly was a good thing, then like I don't want to be friends with you. So
yeah, because it like that sort of idea makes me think of, like, of course, Song of Ice and Fire that I'm obsessed with right now is, you know, one of the biggest huge themes that it's talking about is honor. And George R.R. Martin is making a very crucial point that honor doesn't help you survive.
That's so true. Very true.
So it's a, whereas in maybe Harry Potter, we get a sense of, like, you know, what is honor? Like with the things between Gryffindor and Slytherin, when is it right to pursue self-preservation, to like live to fight another day, or make the noble sacrifice and things like that? Because we get examples of both.
Yeah, sacrificing kind of for the greater good versus one's own self-interest. Interesting. I think just to kind of reiterate the quote by Philip Pullman, I think that is why YA Lit appeals to so many people, is because it does allow you to kind of have space to, the information is presented in a way that it's an enjoyable, you know, it's an enjoyable, easily digestible way to read, but it also brings some complex ideas and thoughts. So that kind of also makes me think or want to ask you the question if it impacted your mood rereading this book.
I don't think it impacted my mood so much. It just gave me pause to consider, you know, the big message of Dumbledore's whole spiel about choice versus ability.
Yeah, I've had some questions about that too. Well, a question, I think. But I think it's, you know, I just didn't know if maybe this book had a high nostalgia factor. I think of certain albums that I listen, and then obviously it elevates my mood. It makes me feel really good. But I also don't, I know you've reread the books, but I don't know how many times you've
read. Yeah, honestly, significantly less than my sister has.
Oh, okay. Okay.
She started reading the books when there were only three out. I started reading the books by the time there were four out.
Okay.
And so all I remember nostalgically about Chamber of Secrets is that I read the first one and then I said, wow, this is amazing. And my sister said, oh, well, the second one's even better. And I'm just like, no, it can't be better. And then I read it and I'm like, yes, it is better, because I'm all for the quiet gothic mystery even back then.
I love it. I love it.
So here, I've got a whole list of questions, you know.
Great.
Probably from going, you know, last time we attached our wrap-up session of Philosopher's Stone with the final chapter. I think moving forward, whether or not the books, you know, that we finish ends on an even or odd number, like our wrap-up sessions will always be their own episode. Oh, okay. Because there's so much going on now.
Yeah, no kidding.
So, first question I have, what was your favorite chapter and why?
I knew you were going to ask me this, and I didn't. I know what my least favorite chapter was. Looking. It was definitely not the spider chapter. It wasn't my least favorite chapter, but it wasn't my favorite. I think, and I don't think this will be too much of a surprise, it was the Death Day Party chapter. Because, I liked the kind of the ambiance of the ghost party, just some of the conversation and things there. I think we had some good conversations about it. I also liked the way it ended. It ended kind of on a cliffhanger. I think to me, there were little cliffhangers in previous in Philosopher's Stone, but this one I really had a hard time not reading the next chapter. So I'll just say the Death Day Party was when we kind of learned what the word squib is with Filch, them being in Filch's parameters. We asked why they skipped the Halloween feast, which I think that would be a regret if I was at Hogwarts. But what was your favorite chapter from the reread?
So my favorite chapter, like I almost picked The Very Secret Diary, but my favorite chapter was chapter 4, Flourish and Blots.
Oh, the bookstore chapter. Right?
Yeah, just because it's, number one, it's a combination of magic and retail therapy.
Yes, beautiful.
Like I will never pass up, you know, you can't go wrong with a good Diagon Alley chapter. And then, you know, additionally, specifically to the bookstore, but also, as we learn in later chapters, it is in that bookstore that Malfoy smuggles the diary into Ginny's possession.
Yeah, so there's a lot of action that happens.
So there's an inciting event that happens in there, but also we get that chapter, it shows Lucius and Arthur like fighting and showing that, you know, adults like don't magically become more mature or let go of their grievances or grudges or prejudices. Like these things extend beyond, you know, the school playground.
Yeah, they're just more, I guess I feel like adults are a little more deceptive about it. So
we learned that, you know, to navigate polite society, we can't be the schoolyard bully the way we used to be. And so we just have to be sneakier about it.
Right. Exactly.
So that was my favorite chapter. So question number two, what was your least favorite chapter and why?
The first chapter. I didn't like it because it was, I kind of almost, the worst birthday, which, you know, everybody knows how much I love the Dursleys. I do not. But also the, we had this conversation when we talked about it. It's like, if you haven't read the first book, go read the first book before you, you know, just don't, we don't need a recap, Harry. Thanks for that. So that was my least favorite chapter. And I mean, I don't kind of have a lot. Those aren't really like fantastic reasons. I don't know. I don't think, but they are my reasons.
Yeah. So in choosing this, I personally made a choice to exclude the Dursley chapters because, of course, they're obvious.
Yeah. Yes.
So ignoring the Dursleys, irrespective of the Dursleys, my least favorite chapter was chapter 12, the Polyjuice Potion.
Oh, why? I'm curious.
Just because, again, like some people look down or don't like the whole Norbert thing in the Philosopher's Stone. Mm-hmm. The Polyjuice Potion, it could have gone wrong in so many ways, more so than it did by Hermione mistaking the cat hair for a human hair.
Right.
And the way that it went so seamless in the sense of, you know, they have to play Crabbe and Goyle as so stupid that that's the only way this whole escapade works.
Yeah.
Yeah, again, excluding the Dursleys, you know, that's what I could come up with.
I feel like I like that too. It did feel a little weak. You like to think Hermione could distinguish people hair from cat hair. I don't know, but
yeah, I can always tell Bacon's hair because Bacon is that tabby where like 2/3 of the lower half of his hair is black, but the very tip is a little blonde.
I love that. My calico passed away a couple months ago, and I love finding little calico patterned hairs still. It's pretty cute. It makes me happy.
Yeah. So question number three, who was your favorite character outside of the Golden Trio?
Oh my gosh. I thought I was so ready for all these. Okay. Professor Sprout.
Oh, why?
As a person that just likes to garden, loves to grow things. I don't have like a huge garden, but you know, I grow herbs and stuff like that. And I've made a few attempts at making little tinctures and things like that. I appreciate her breadth of knowledge in that area. And that would be a class that I would just, I'm basically the Neville Longbottom, right? Like I would go hang out in her class and learn everything and maybe I'd be decent about it, at it. So she was my favorite. I look forward to her herbology class. Did you have a favorite character during this?
My favorite outside the Golden Trio was Lucius Malfoy.
Okay, you have mentioned old Lucius a couple times. So you like his, tell me about him. I won't put words in your mouth. So you
talk again, about. I like him as a secondary villain because yes. He's just that slimy old school patriarch of this wealthy family that represents the ultimate in the wizarding elite. That he doesn't have to even work, like he doesn't even have a job or position. Like, you know, he can volunteer and be part of this board of governors for whatever, because he's just that old school gentleman who doesn't have to work.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that makes, I mean, he's
and this an, is I'm, heavily fluent and this is heavily influenced by how well James Isaac played him.
Okay. Yeah. I haven't watched the movies. Because I'm supposed to be in the dark. So I could watch.
And he has a pimp cane with a snake head on it.
Dude, he does look like kind of a wizard pimp. That's what I would call him.
So that was my favorite character outside. Question number four. Who was your least favorite character outside the Golden Trio?
I ragged on him a lot. And I didn't like Gilderoy Lockhart. And I think the reason I didn't like him, other than he's not a very likable character, is I still feel a little weird about his, the poetic justice of his memory loss. I get it, but I kind of was hoping for a different outcome there. So now the story, you know, and I guess now that I'm thinking about it, oh man, I really screwed up on my favorite character or my least favorite character because I should have said the giant spider, but I mean, whatever. I feel like if you removed Gilderoy from the book, the hole in the story wouldn't have been like, it wouldn't have been missing a lot if he wasn't there.
Yeah.
But what about you?
My least favorite character was Aragog.
good choice. That guy's horrible.
And not because he's an evil giant spider. Well, partly because he's evil, like, but not because of his arachnid. It's because he was not helpful. He had the opportunity to be that, oh, Hagrid's in trouble, like take me to the castle, let me speak to whoever, you know. Again, he doesn't have to give a crap about Harry or Ron. He should just care enough about Hagrid to use them as messengers, as go-betweens, but he didn't give a crap about any of that.
And maybe it's just like his age, maybe he's just kind of over it, I don't know. Maybe. But you're right. Perhaps. He wasn't helpful.
Yeah. So again, not because he's an evil giant spider. It's because he did not help our companions, even in a selfish way.
No, he really didn't.
Question number five. What was your favorite magical item that appeared in this book?
Great question. I'm trying to think about the magical items that appeared. Okay. This feels like an obvious one. I'm going to say Tom Riddle's diary. Because. Me too. Okay, it's pretty cool. I mean, granted, the like what happens is pretty messed up, and especially preying on Jenny Weasley. But the concept is that is a pretty neat way to make that happen. So
yeah, as creepy as it is, it was a pretty badass piece of magic and means to carry whatever memory recollection you want it to carry.
Yeah, I don't know if I would want one personally, but I can imagine reading or, you know, kind of having a conversation with, and I don't know, thinking of grandparents or things like that to give some kind of living history. I mean, you know, I'm thinking about older people who we didn't like record them telling stories about their past. It would be, I don't know. I think it would be cool. Make it happen, yeah. Somebody.
Yeah, for me, it was a tie between, you know, Riddle's Diary and the Sword of Gryffindor.
I forgot about the Sword of Gryffindor. That one had a pretty badass, what do we call it, use, you know? It's pretty cool.
But I think for us, we're book people, and yeah. I've started to get back into journaling to vent all my rage with my day job. But yeah.
It's helpful. It's helpful.
Indeed it is. So yeah, we're both unanimous in match for item, best one being Riddle's Diary. So yeah. Question number 6. What was your favorite spell from this book?
My favorite spell. I'm sorry, I'm trying to do this. Ugh. I don't know why this one stumped me. It's because the one that came to mind right away was the polyjuice potion, but I was kind of like, yeah, let's not.
Well, I guess maybe we can do spells and potions as well.
Oh, that's a potion, yeah. Maybe the one in the dueling club, which kind of like, not the one that made Ron belch slugs. I wasn't super into that, but oh gosh,
the one that Snape used against Gilderoy?
Yes. Expelliarmus.
Expelliarmus.
Yes, that one. Yeah, why not? It's pretty cool.
You and Harry both.
Well, cool. I'm in good company, I think. But
my favorite spell also came from the dueling club, but not from Snape, from Malfoy. I want a snake conjuring spell.
That is a great spell. Now that I'm, you know, reflecting back on it, it's a terrifying one.
Yeah, just throw a like cobra at my enemies.
Well, hey, I guess like if it's like a rubber snake, I guess you could get a similar effect if you, I don't know. But yeah, why not? Good one. I like that one. The slug one is my least favorite. I don't know if you're going to ask that question, but yes. That's my least.
Oh my God, the way they did that in the movie. Again, like people harp on the kids, like when they were kids, that they were bad actors. But at least like Rupert Grant, like was asked to do a lot of stuff in like movie 2, and he did it pretty well.
I can't say I would be. I can't judge the acting because I could. I'm sure I would not have done better as a kid. I was very shy, so that would have been really bad.
All right, Ethan. Question number 7. What was your favorite magical creature that appeared in this book?
Well, I think it goes without saying the spider was not my favorite magical creature. I think you could argue that that's a magical creature.
It's a giant spider. It is a magical creature.
Yeah, not a fan. Not a fan. I kind of like the mandrakes. That was in this chapter. I guess would you consider that a creature or that's a plant?
It's a sentient moving plant. Yeah, we'll put this both fauna and sentient floral.
Okay. Not because that they have like deadly screams. That is terrifying, but it is kind of they actually were used for some good later on in the book. And I just think it's kind of a cool use of a plant. So I'm going to go with the mandrakes right now. What was yours?
The phoenix fox.
Oh my God. I can't believe I didn't say fox. Yes. Okay.
The fox, you know, it was tough between, you know, fox, the phoenix, and the big ass king of serpents, the basilisk. But
yeah,
the fox is of course, the phoenix is always a nice addition when you want, in a fantasy story, when you want allusions to death and reincarnation and the cyclical nature of life, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And especially I like the phoenix because, you know, there are roots to the phoenix myth, specifically like a lot of unicorns and dragons, like a lot of that is very like Western, but the phoenix is a very prominent, you know, folkloric legend in Middle Eastern cultures, especially Persian.
Oh, that's really interesting. I didn't know that was especially in Persian. So then that makes that I had a question that I wanted to ask. We kind of talked about the name Fox.
With Guy Fox. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think it's any, is there anything different? Do you think it's related to Guy Fawkes that they named it that? I didn't know if there was anything.
Like, I personally have no idea if there's some interview where someone made that reference or confirmed that. I haven't read it or seen it.
Well, okay. I just, well, the phoenix portrayal in, like, Persian storytelling or whatever. Do you have anything
I don't have any that? Specific one, just because that in Persia, or rather I should say modern day Iran, there is this sort of tug of war between Iran's Islamic identity and its pre-Islamic identity, and part of its pre-Islamic identity is all the old school folklore, you know, and legends that came before Islam showed up. And a lot of times those pre-Islamic traditions are kind of used in a way as a sort of political defiance against, you know, in the current Iranian regime. Like, they're officially called the Islamic Republic. It's an Islamic theocracy that everyone hates. Right. So I don't know any specific legends of how the phoenix, you know, is worked into their stories. Just knowing that that's a pre-Islamic sort of symbol. There's even one group, I forget, like, you know, there are a variety of, like, sort of oppositional groups, you know, in the Iranian diaspora. And I know one of them was literally called, like, the Phoenix Project, which I think their, you know, goal was to, like, you know, just have discussions of, you know, how do we get past this terrible regime?
Gotcha. That's, I just, that's interesting. It's also interesting, the different characters' prevalence in different cultures and how often they show up and things like that, and how they show up.
Question number 8. In your opinion, what was the most gothic element in the book?
That is a very hard choice between Tom Riddle's diary and the Chamber of Secrets. I'm going to go with Tom Riddle's diary because of Tom Riddle himself and the whole interaction with persuading Jenny to write in the diary, to do these different things. Like, I feel like that's the basis of some gothic stories. So that is my most gothic element, is Tom Riddle's diary.
And essentially, he is the ghost that is possessing her.
That's very gothic, too. So there's a lot of gothic-ness around that diary in its, like, physical manifestation, and then the encounter at the end in the Chamber of Secrets with his kind of shadowy appearance. I feel pretty confident in my Tom Riddle diary.
Okay. Mine was the fucking Chamber of Secrets.
How could it not be?
Yeah, well, I guess, how do I put this? Like, there's so many gothic elements in Harry Potter, and I think Chamber of Secrets comes out as a super gothic one, although there's plenty of gothic stuff in the other books, but I think in terms of pure ambience, and if we're going into gothic architecture,
yes,
like, more specifically in the niche of an architectural standpoint, the freaking Chamber of Secrets, which is a hidden chamber within the castle, which is already gothic enough.
Yeah, absolutely. It's pretty.
And again, the past that's attached to the Chamber of Secrets and all that.
Yeah, it was really, I mean, even as confident as I am in Tom Riddle's diary, it is hard to find any more gothic element thus far than the motherfucking Chamber of Secrets.
My last question that I have, what was your absolute favorite quote from this book?
Well, I'm sure Dumbledore said it. And I actually, okay, this was an easy one for me to pick because I think it brings up a good question. It's our choices, Harry, that show what we truly are far more than our abilities.
Of course, yes.
That's a great quote.
Yeah, because, and again, very pertinent to the story of, you know, setting up the similarities between Harry and Tom Riddle, and how, coming from similar negative backgrounds, their paths diverge significantly.
Yeah, and in like the last book, I think Dumbledore, in my mind, gets these just stellar, very philosophical, I'm sure, I'm just imagining myself, if I were a parent reading this to my kid, I would probably sit there and be like, that's pretty intense for, and then just, you know, think about, that's something to think about later. So it's a great, It's hard to find a bad Dumbledore quote, maybe. Maybe his like request for lemon drops, but that's not even that bad. What was yours?
Because Dumbledore, you know, first book he's talking about death, that it's not that bad.
Right.
So that's a big hefty one. And now we're talking about nature versus nurture and how do we allow that to dictate our decisions.
He is going all in on the heavy themes, Dumbledore. I would expect nothing less, though, to be honest.
My favorite quote was from Ron, "When in doubt, go to the library."
Oh, that's a good one, too. And especially that's for a couple good. Of book nerds.
Like, that's just a good quote to anyone in life.
It really is. It really
especially really is. In our current realm of fake news.
I was going to say, now, if he would have said, like, when in doubt, go to Facebook, I would have been like, eh, maybe not so good. But yes, when in doubt, go to the library.
Yeah, that's, and it's such good advice. Yet he says it very flippantly because this he says it right as Hermione leaves, right? And then she gets attacked because she wants to confirm her theory before she goes blabbering it out. And he's just shrugging. He's like, oh, it's just Hermione. When in doubt, go to the library.
So she made a great decision. Like,
yeah, because it's just, again, it's just said so, like, in such a flippant and humorous manner in the moment. But I'm just thinking about all the things people will protest for, quote, even die for, march on the Capitol Hill for.
Right.
Like, what are the sources? Like, go to the library, damn it.
Yeah, just think about if everybody took that, some of that, and said, hey, I'm going to do some research. Like, actual going to the library research. I'm not to slam any research, but taking
like,
a minute.
And I don't want to diss all of like digital like media and stuff, but I justify getting my news from Facebook, but that's because I am in a very specific niche of international studies in my career. And so everyone is sharing legitimate resources, the New York Times and blah, blah, blah. So like in that way, I have no shame. But not everyone in your social circle may be sharing that. And if someone showed up with this like crazy ass Onion article, like that, you know, wasn't the Onion, but was eBay, I would just be like, what?
Right. Yeah. I think you make a good distinction there because I do. Yeah. I follow various accounts on, you know, like on Instagram, weirdly, which is kind of a weird place for print media, but presented in an interesting way. I'm going to follow that. Or if I see a friend share an article. Now, if I see a friend share an article from, you know, oh gosh, some of these news, quote unquote, news organizations that are mainly just opinion pieces, not really news, then that's a big difference. So I think the metaphorical library could be, you know, vetted, legitimate information, not random ramblings about how Bill Gates has implanted us all with the vaccine. So,
like, what do they have against Bill Gates anyway? I never found out.
No, that very is, I guess, just that he has money. Like, that's all I can figure out. And that he, I don't know. I don't know, man.
His company just naturally veers towards the liberal elite because
I guess.
I don't know. Well, I guess, but it's like, when in doubt, go to the library. But like, what? How do we get to the point where we don't trust the library, that we think everything is just an extension of this elitist government that wants to hold you down?
Yeah, I don't know, and I'm just not.
Sorry, I'm going on a tangent, but
no.
Again, I would send students abroad in like my job I used to work at to post-Soviet Turkic republics, which are real police states. And they want to bitch how they're so oppressed. And I'm like, I want to drop you in Baku, Azerbaijan, and see how far you got.
Yeah. Yeah. It's. I think there's a lot of complaining about oppression from people who have not experienced it. So it's just, it's absurd and it's sad as it, these people get in super deep. I don't know. I watched this documentary about QAnon and it's pretty interesting. I feel better informed about Q. But it also is like, to me, my takeaway was it was some person on Reddit that thought this was really funny and took the joke and the joke went too far. So I don't know. Don't get your news from Reddit. I think what we're talking about is, you know, yeah, you can kind of like find some information on a social media platform. But my Aunt Sally, who's, you know, rambling about the microchip and the vaccine, it's like, okay, that's not news, lady. That's just ridiculousness.
Yeah, like I remember I read one post that it was about, oh, like, I don't know, something about the vaccine. Like it was with the Washington Post and someone was down there like, what is the point of getting a vaccine? That just makes you sick and all these crazy liberals and they can't even tell a boy from a girl. And I'm just like, holy crap. We went from like anti-vaccine to like transphobia.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's like those two things that, oh wow.
But anyway, good quote for anyone. When in doubt, yes, go to the library. And that does not include alt-right wing social media.
Right, exactly. I think that is our point that we're making. That is not the library, everybody, just in case, you know.
No, that is not a library. That is an abomination that should have burned instead of the Great Library of Alexandria.
Exactly. Amen to that. Exactly.
So those are all the questions I had. Did you have any more questions?
I had some. I think we could probably, I have a list, but I think I'm going to skip around. And most of these are kind of, I think I'm going to frame, they're a little more open-ended and less specific, but how did your opinion of the book change as you reread it? Because I know, again, I've said this is my first time reading these, and then Amy's not her first time reading these. So yeah, how did your opinion of the book change as you reread it?
How has the book evolved? I think just acknowledging how dark it is. And again, people say it's a simple children's book in the way that, as my sister put it, it has a tidy ending still. But still, that tidy ending involved gouging a giant snake's eyes out and stabbing the roof of its mouth with this Athenian sword.
Yeah. That, I'm just laughing because that scene was so intense and I'm like, oh my gosh, who is this written for?
Yeah, and I think also kind of made me show that, you know, it, in a way, it doesn't matter about, from linguistics you're learning, it doesn't matter maybe necessarily the exact language always, but the tone, or I should explain, I should rephrase that. The language does matter very much in portraying the tone for whatever action you're trying to, you know, explain in a story, because there have been like linguistic studies of like the, you know, legal cases where literally like prosecutors and defense, like they could sway the jury's opinion just by rephrasing, you know, this guy crashed into this guy, like, you know, in a car wreck. Like, did he like, you know, crash? Did he smash? Did he like bump into it? Like just using various degrees of various synonyms that implied a similar thing that could impact a jury.
I hope to not find out pretty soon.
Yeah, because you just got jury duty.
I know. Oh my gosh.
So, like from that, I kind of realized, you know, for this book and then some of the others, like all of the stuff is dark. It's just how the tonal, how Harry the writer is making a choice to go from lighter to darker, even though everything within his whole series has very dark components.
Yeah, I think that to ask myself the question as I read it, I think that this kind of gave me a feel of where the rest of the series was going. Moreover, the first book, that this was definitely going to slowly delve into some scarier things, maybe even gorier things without being explicit. So that's kind of how I have never said that these books felt lighthearted by any means. But this was the book that definitely kind of, I feel like if I'm on a roller coaster, like I'm kind of descending into the darker elements of the story, which was exciting. This is kind of a silly question, but I think it will be interesting. If you could give this book a new title, what would it be?
Oh, interesting. Harry Potter and... that's a tough one. Ooh.
I'm going to say Harry Potter and The Secret Diary. Somehow.
Yeah, well, I was not going to fall upon, you know, Tom Riddle's diary. So I'm just trying to think of Harry Potter and frickin' Excalibur.
There we go. That would get some people to pick it up.
Or, well, yeah, Harry Potter and the Sword of Gryffindor.
Ooh, I like that. That's very on brand, too, for the series. I'm going to keep that question. I feel like that's a good question to ask.
Although that would break the sort of cycle, because actually, like, I've kind of noticed, like, maybe not at this reading, but maybe, like, my previous rereading was that there's actually a cyclical nature in the titles. Like,
oh, really?
First we have Philosopher's Stone, which the title, you know, is an object. Then we have the second one where it's like a location. And then the third one, Prisoner of Azkaban, is a person. So when we hit books 4, 5, and 6, it repeats. An object, Goblet of Fire.
Okay.
And then the fifth one, Order of the Phoenix, you know, /place/organization. Right. And then the sixth book, Half-Blood Prince, is a person. And then finally the seventh book goes back to an object, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows.
Oh, that's very interesting. That's very interesting. I feel like
so. Yeah, to have changed it would mean changing the whole cyclical nature. Like Amanda with Fox and Foxhound, she was mentioning on their podcast that someone's written a whole book about like the ring cyclical nature of the Harry Potter series and how things in book one parallel things in book five and a lot of things in book two parallel things in book six.
Interesting. I think that this is a good breaking the rules question. So, because what else, you know, if they, it didn't follow a pattern, what would it be? Which scene in the book stuck with you or maybe not like touched your heart, but made you pause, made you think about it a little more? What scene from this book kind of, I don't know, did it for you?
Tom Riddle's Daddy Issues monologue.
Yes. Yeah, that was good.
Like, did you really think I was going to keep my filthy muggle father's name?
That was just like the most emo. I just felt like I was
angsty.
I felt like I was like watching the guy from My Chemical Romance or something. Don't hate on me, anybody. Stand there and tell a tale. So I'd have no problem with My Chemical Romance, so don't come for me. I know some people really feel strongly about that.
What about you?
You know, I think that the opening of the Chamber of Secrets really stuck with me. I just feel like I could see that in my mind, having been very far removed from the movie. If I had seen it or not, I'm not sure. I just could see it in my mind's eye, just like what a jarring thing that would be to come upon. And so I think with my favorite chapter as well, thought that that was a really interesting way to kind of set things off in the.
When you talk about the entrance, are you talking about Moaning Myrtle's bathroom or the big like sort of snake gate right before like the main hall?
Yeah, just seeing the words on the wall, the Chamber of Secrets is now open. So just seeing that painted on the wall and then poor Mrs. Norris petrified hanging there. I can just imagine coming upon something like that and how jarring that would be. And then, you know, that kind of leads to the kids going and talking to the professors. And we talked to Amanda and Kevin about how they kind of, the teachers have a life and have
petty squabbles backstory amongst themselves.
Yeah, exactly. Petty squabbles. That's something we haven't talked about with the Lockhart, that whole thing. But I just thought that was it's something that I thought about more than some other chapters, more than a Quidditch chapter, I guess I could say. Looking through my questions here. Oh, okay. I like this question. This is very specific to Chamber of Secrets. Why was it important for students to know the legends as well as the history of Hogwarts? It says Hermione's question to Professor Binns was, "Please, sir, don't legends always have a basis in fact?" And I just before you answer this, I think this is more of a good thing to talk about. This is a reason I love ghost stories, is because of the, you know, kind of real story that that presents itself on the Gothic podcast when we talked about Home Before Dark. You know, I think that was one of the things I really enjoyed about that, is the house had a story, be it true or not, whatever. You know, there was some truth to it, there's a house in the city I live in that is supposedly haunted. And I read all the history and it's like, whether it's haunted or not, you know, who's to say, but the history behind it is endlessly fascinating. So with all of that, why is it important for the students to know legends as well as the history of Hogwarts?
Well, this kind of, I've actually been thinking about this. Well, not that exact question, but you triggered a concept that I have been thinking about quite a lot lately, is just the whole metaphysical, why do we tell ourselves stories in the first place?
Man, that's a big question.
And I've been thinking about this from the position that I was raised Christian, more specifically Lutheran, and I left that to become a pagan, which in paganism, there is no holy book. But even when I was a Christian, I never was a maniac that took the Bible literally. The point of the Bible was to, you know, draw upon it the moral values of the stories.
Right.
And so by leaving Christianity and coming into a faith that has no holy book, it's not so much, I've kind of gotten to the point now where all books are holy, or what can I learn from these characters?
That's really interesting. You're talking about paganism not having a book. Is that because of, sorry, this is just a curiosity, so I'm going to ask. Is that because of, like, traditionally, like, let's say you came from a family of pagans, there would have been a book that the family created? Or is it just...
Again, it's so... The big allure of paganism is to not have any strict, rigid rules, that you can use your mind and critical thinking skills to decide what is morally right and wrong and whatever, and not having to engage in the hypocrisy of cherry-picking certain values of a holy book and still claim that you're devout and all that stuff. And so, you know, in paganism, a lot of times, especially if you identify as a witch, the whole sort of book culture is not like a holy book. It's you creating your own grimoire.
Yes, the grimoire. Okay. I didn't want to misuse terminology that I didn't fully understand, but that's something I just wondered as...
Yeah,
but that's more of a collection of familial, like, understandings, or I don't know.
Yeah, the grimoire is your own, like, book of spells or rituals or, you know, whatever. And so, tying into your question, you know, the legend serves as much as the history, because the legend is telling a story and the story has a moral point. And in the case of the Chamber of Secrets legend, it's feeding into this sort of terror that Slytherin was so bigoted and so bad that he created this chamber and a monster purely for the sake to rid the world of, like, Muggleborns at Hogwarts.
Ooh, that's so dark. I can't believe that.
And that's a worthy legend to think about and for academics to analyze, because it's, you know, it shows how bad the racism and ethnic purity is a problem in the society.
Yeah.
Just the simple history of Slytherin got pissed off and left the school. That doesn't have the same punch as, and he created a whole chamber underneath the castle with a giant snake in it.
Exactly.
To make a point.
He went to some extreme lengths. I think another thing that you talk about, the importance of storytelling. I mean, in my work life, I am often asked, like, what's the story? I'm like, the story is to do this process correctly. We don't need to make it that rich. But sometimes, you know, I understand why they're asking the question. It's because if there's, like, an intriguing way to understand the information, people will remember it better. So I don't know. Obviously, we like stories because Amy has several
book podcasters.
Exactly. So obviously there's an appeal. I think that does make information. I don't know. I think it's also a testament to when they're in this history class, when it's something or something that they can kind of, like you said, there's a whole chamber to just rid the world of this certain type of people. The the kids really are interested in this history, finally, instead of just somebody standing up front and just rambling, you know, nonsense at them. Not really nonsense, history, actual history, but his delivery is not the best.
Leave something to be desired.
Yes, yes, yes.
But yeah, legends are important because again, it's just an extension of how, again, I don't know how to frame this fancily or academically, but it's a testament to why, like, things like Greek mythology and Norse mythology has endured after all this time, because there is a point in trying to create, tell stories and give physical manifestation to these various archetypes, like abstract concepts like love and death and betrayal and all that shit.
Yes, exactly. I guess I'll ask one more question. It's just like a little more, again, they're more general about fantasy writing and Harry Potter, and but we can just focus it on the last two books that we've read. So how does the fantasy element of these two books help readers discover more about themselves and others? So let's just concentrate, I guess, on the Chamber of Secrets. I think the choices thing. I guess I'm asking you this question, so I shouldn't ask it first.
Well, I think, especially in the Harry Potter series, the magical elements and fantasy elements help us to hypothesize various moral dilemmas. And again, how would we respond to them if we had these certain magical abilities or resources available to us? Like, and people have been doing that, you know, Plato and the Greeks were doing that, the whole question of the ring of Gygas, which is the ring that makes you invisible. And so posing the question of if you're invisible and you remove yourself from all culpability and ability to be discovered, would you still be the same moral person as you were if people are watching you?
That is so funny that, I mean, I know we've talked about it, but for some reason, my husband said something and said it made you invisible instead of invincible. And then we started like saying, like, what would you do if you were actually invisible? And I have to say that asking myself that question, mine was like, I'd go rob a bank so I wouldn't have to pay for stuff. And then I was like, well, maybe I shouldn't have magic. But I think that that's also, I think what you're, how you responded is an interesting thing to think about people. Like, if my first inclination was I'm going to go rob a bank, maybe I shouldn't have magical powers, but it would be interesting to think about some people who think they're, you know, not chaotic good, but they're just chaotic, well, that they're just good, and say, okay, now cool, you have all these magical powers, what are you going to do? And then, you know, if the answer is rob a bank, maybe I just need to take a moment and ask myself some questions. I don't know.
So again, the ancient Greeks were doing it, and we do it to this day, to explore sort of, again, these big moral, ethical questions, and we will continue to do it. And like in, again, Game of Thrones, how does one, like, balance the quote-unquote, not that there was any notion of international law in, like, medieval history, but let's say you have three freaking dragons and you want to conquer a country or a continent. Do you restrain yourself, or do you let the dragons just burn freaking everything?
Based on the show, I know how that ended. I think that was, I don't know, I think we'll continue to ask those questions as the series progresses and things are heightened more and more. But that's all the questions I had for you tonight.
Alrighty then, and thus concludes our wrap-up session for the Chamber of Secrets. Tune in next time, where we are going to begin Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban.
I think I know a little bit about this one. I'm excited.
Yes, it's definitely a popular one. At least the undoubtedly the most popular of the first three.
Sweet. Okay.
So yeah, so those will be the first two chapters, Owl Post and Aunt Marge's Big Mistake.
Oh gosh. Oh yeah, some Dursley chapters, I'm sure.
Catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye.